This meeting is now being recorded.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm good. I would like to welcome everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. And welcome to the RPM Subteam for U.S. Providers meeting on the 28th of February, 2018 at 2300 UTC. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. As a reminder to everyone, please state your name before speaking for recording purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoiding background noise. With this, I will turn the meeting back over to Philip Colwin.
Hey, thank you, and welcome Yvette, Justin, and Michael, and good afternoon, good evening, and good morning, whatever it is for you. I appreciate your being on. While we have a small group, we're going to we'll see if we use the full 90 minutes, but let's go for at least an hour and try to get some more work done before we continue in San Juan. And I just looked over Ariel's summary of last week's call, and it looks like we wrapped up last week with Section 8. So how many, can you just give me a show of hands, how many were on last week's call of those who are on today's call? Michael was, Justin, I guess Yvette was not. Well, what we're doing is just going through the rules and seeing what objective questions the rules suggest. So we're going to continue in that vein. We stopped at the end of Section 8 last week, so we're now beginning with Section 9, which is at the bottom of page 10 of the document. So we're 5/8 through the document. Section 9 is about language and proceedings. Requires the complaint to be submitted in English. The response can be in English or in one of the languages used for the notice of the complaint. The examiner is supposed to be fluent in English, and the language of the response and will determine in which language to issue its determination in its sole discretion. In the absence of response, the language will be in English. The provider is not responsible for translating any documents other than the notice of the complaint. So basically this says English is a default language, and the examiner is supposed to be fluent in English and gets to determine which language to issue its determination. Ariel, staff did a survey last week of the web pages of providers, and it appeared that some of the examiners, based on their listed qualifications, were not fluent in English. Oh, hi, Lori Shulman.
Hey,
thank you. Now we have
hi.
Now we have an unequivocally official quorum. So
I should have stayed silent, huh?
No, now you can't leave. You can check in, but you can't leave. This is like the Hotel California. So, and staff has put that up on the screen and noticed that an indication of English fluency, all the providers did not indicate whether the examiners were fluent in English. That doesn't necessarily mean they're not. And there also might be cases where, I guess they need to be fluent in English since the complaint must be in English and the default language is in English. So that suggests for Section 9 that we need some further inquiry to the providers about whether all their examiners are indeed fluent in English as well as regional languages that might be used by a respondent in a particular URS case. I don't think, since we're on Section 9, I just wanted to refer back to this table for that point. I don't want to go through the whole table here now, though it did indicate substantial compliance, but not 100% by all the providers with all the requirements of what was to be posted at their website. But so we can look at that, but I'd say they all get at least a BB+. We don't have any abject failures here. So can we go back to the rules, back to Section 9 in terms of the document? All right, so if you'll, all right, we're back on the bottom of page 10. I think other than further inquiry based to the staff review of what's at their websites, of whether the all the examiners are fluent in English, since it says examiner shall be fluent in English and in the language of the response, which can be the language used for the notice of complaint. Does anyone see any other questions to the provider suggested by Section 9? And if not, we can say we've dealt with it and move on to 10. I don't hear anyone or see any hands raised. So arising out of Section 9, we just want further inquiry to the providers that all of their examiners are indeed fluent in English. And who's that joining?
Sorry, it's Lori. I had audio problems, so I had them dial out to me.
Oh, okay.
I just muted my speakers. They were going in and out. I'm sorry.
All right. So we're on Section 10. To ensure expedient proceedings, the examiner may not request further statements or documents. The only question I can see suggested there is whether an examiner has ever violated that rule, if providers can identify any situation where they've not complied with that. Michael, I see your hand up. Go ahead.
Just going back to the last question, would it be useful to ask them if they've ever encountered or know of challenges in understanding based on the based on linguistic difficulties? I mean, presumably it would be a yes or no and fairly easy for them to respond if that's come up before.
Yeah, I think that's fine, Michael. We can add that. That's an easy question. Like most of the questions we're getting out of this, they're simple to answer and quite objective just based upon the rules themselves. Justin, yes. Go ahead.
Hi, Justin, for the record. So I wonder if we could go back to Rule 6A based on the table that Ariel has prepared and circulated. Just in terms of the publishing of the qualifications, the examiner's qualifications.
Sure. Staff is putting that back.
Yeah, so
hold on, let's wait till we get it up.
So the table indicates that not all the qualifications are published in the case of ADN, DRC, and Forum. So did we want to pose a question as to why?
I think that's a perfectly acceptable question, and we might also in our report recommend that ICANN enforce compliance with that requirement. It seems to me that it's not a heavy lift for a provider to post at the website someone they've chosen to be an examiner to post their qualifications. I note that MFSD has posted the qualifications of all of their examiners. They have the fewest number, 23. The forum has 120. They've posted qualifications for 118 of those. The biggest gap seems to be at ADN DRC. They have 161, the most examiners, and also the most who don't have qualifications listed. I think with ADN DRC, they really have a number of offices throughout Asia which have some autonomy from each other, is my understanding, and we might want to look at whether the problem arises from a particular location rather than what I'm saying, to have a more distributed system with separate offices run somewhat separately in different cities throughout Asia. So we might want to inquire whether the problem is centered in a particular location. But overall, I think we need to ask why they haven't listed them. I mean, they ought to know that they're qualified, and it's easy to list their qualifications. And I think we also want to recommend that ICANN make sure that these accredited providers are listing the qualifications for all the examiners. I also note that it's interesting, the forum has 120 examiners, and less than half have non-English language skills based on what's in their qualifications, whereas ADNDRC lists 161 and 150 have non-English language, which raises a question, since they have 161 and 119 don't have qualifications available. How do we determine that 150 are fluent in something in addition to English? So we'll need to dig into that. But Justine, was that? Did you have anything else to say on this? Or did that address your concerns? I see Justine typed in yes, please. So let's go back then.
No, I'm sorry. That was before.
What's that?
Sorry, Phil, that was before. So you asked if I had additional questions, and the answer is no.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So let's go back to the rules. And back to page 10, or 11 now. Okay, 11, section 11 is in-person hearings. No in-person hearings, including teleconference, video conference, or web conference. I can't imagine that, particularly given the fee that the providers are receiving, that they've ever conducted any hearing that they've, I think all these URS decisions have been based upon the written submissions with nothing beyond that. We can check that with the providers just to confirm it, but I'd be shocked if any of them said that they had done any kind of teleconference, video conference, or web conference, since it's prohibited and since that would add considerable time and expense. So, Justine, did you have a new question, or is that an old hand? Okay, thanks. Now we're at Section 12, default. So basically, the respondent has 14 days unless they've asked for an extension, and it's been granted. And this says that if they haven't responded in that time, the complaint proceeds to default, that the provider appoints an examiner to review the complaint for a prima facie case, including complete and appropriate evidence. At that time, the provider shall notify the registry operator that the registrant is prohibited from changing content on the site and that the registrant is prohibited from changing the who is information. And then the examiner prepares a written default determination. If the examiner finds that a complaint has made a prima facie case according to the U.S. procedure, and that's by clear and convincing evidence, that's the burden of proof, the standard of evidence in URS, The default determination shall state that, including any additional written reasoning the examiner wishes to append, and shall order suspension of the domain name for which a prima facie case has been established. Subsection E, if the complainant hasn't made a prima facie case, the default determination shall so state, including any additional comments, any additional reasoning. Okay, if a response is filed within 6 months after a default determination, or within any extension period granted under the URS procedure, the provider shall notify the registry operator. Now, at that point, of course, the domain would have been suspended. Justine, I see your hand up. Let me just get through this section, and then I'll call on you. The provider shall notify the registry operator, and the registry operator shall modify the name service so that the domain name resolve to the relevant IP addresses but remain locked. And so basically the domain upon filing of the response, the very late response after default determination and suspension, content is displayed again, but it remains locked. It can't be moved to another registrar. And then the final part is that if a party, in the absence of exceptional circumstances, whatever that might be, does not comply with any provision of or requirement under these rules, the examiner can draw inferences from them that the examiner considers appropriate. So I see two hands up. I think the main thing we want to ask here, other than if we're going to review any of the cases, is that in what number or percentage of cases has a response come in after default determination? The provider should know that certainly, because that would be a fairly rare circumstance, I'm imagining. And also whether examiners have ever made use of their authority under subsection F to draw inferences from noncompliance by the complainant or the respondent with any one of the rules. So having said that, let me call on Justine and then on Lori. Go ahead, Justine.
Hi, it's Justine from the record. In relation to 12B, can I ask how the registry operator or anyone apart from the registry operator prohibits the registrant from changing content found on the site? I mean, who actually has control of content of a website?
Well, I'm making this answer up based on my own knowledge, which may have gaps, but the registry operator has that WHOIS information, at least the basics, even for those legacy TLDs that still have thin WHOIS, and they can prevent it from being altered by the registrant. So I think they can also, of course, will suspend the domain. They wouldn't do that until there's been a decision, but they certainly could lock the WHOIS information. And the URS, unlike the UDRP, involves registrar action, but URS involves registry action. So does that answer your question?
Well, to the extent of WHOIS, which I understand, I'm referring to content on the website, though.
Well, B doesn't...
Would that be the same control that the RO exercises over domain?
So are you suggesting that we ask a question whether registries are... I'm assuming that this rule was created with a belief an informed belief that registries could block any change in content. Are you suggesting we should check on that?
If we could, please, because I think I've heard someone raise this issue before, so I was just seeking clarity more than anything. Thank you.
Okay, well, let's staff note that as a potential question to make sure that registries can accomplish this. Lori, go ahead.
Yeah, I had typed a question in the chat a while back on another section. I just wanted to get caught about the hearings. I agree with you, Phil, that this procedure is way too fast for hearings, in my opinion, but I would be curious to know if it's ever been raised as an issue or if anybody's been asking for hearings, or is that something we need to look at? Not just assume, okay, they're forbidden, we're done, but I'm wondering if there's some level of inquiry that we would make regarding that. That's my first point.
Mm-hmm.
And my second point is on this section. I think I'm not understanding. In full disclosure, I've never done a URS. The URS was implemented after I left practice of this particular. So if there's a default, then the loser has 6 months to appeal. And if the loser, if the site is actually up and running, I shouldn't say loser. I should say the respondent. If the respondent has lost, and so basically the site remains in stasis for 6 months, is that what we're saying here? It's got to look exactly the same. It can't be, you know, it's not going to be taken down. It's just going to be basically frozen in time. I think that's how I understand this.
You know, I'm going to, I don't know the answer to that, Lori. First of all, I want to say, someone needs to mute.
Hello?
Yeah, I hope someone muted. Okay, the echo is gone. Well, I want to say two things. One, pointing out that when there's a default, which is a non-response by the respondent within the 14-day period or the longer period if they requested additional time, they don't lose the case. Then the examiner makes a determination based simply upon what's the facts laid out in the complaint, and the respondent still may win. And I think Barry has identified some cases, a small number, where that has in fact happened. My belief, staff can look into this and inform us, is that when the examiner determines that the domain was registered and is being used in bad faith, that it's suspended, and suspension means it no longer resolves, that there's some kind of notice there, but that there's no content anymore. So it's kind of in a state of suspended animation. I'm not sure what goes back up if and when the respondent comes back within that six-month period after the default determination and says, hey, I just woke up and I want to respond to the original complaint. So we can look. I think the first question is, has any respondent ever filed a response after the initial determination, but before the running of that six-month period? But we can have staff look into, it's just a factual inquiry, what happens with a domain that's been subject to a URS once it's been found to be infringing. Justine,
yeah,
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, and Justine put in
the
chat.
Yeah, Justine.
After. Okay, go ahead, Justine.
Sorry, Phil. Yeah, just on to the chat, yeah, that's what I said. My understanding from reading the entire rules is that if you have a default determination, then the domain is suspended. Default determination in favor of the complainant, you should clarify. Then the domain is suspended. If there is a subsequent appeal process or a de novo review, then the suspension is turned into a lock. So with suspension, the, like you said, Phil, the domain name will not resolve. It's redirected to a notice, but if it's going back to a lock, then it will resolve. And the registrant will be able to change the UAC, the OS records. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you, Justine. That's my understanding as well. I see that Lori has posted, well, she's still showing as being in the chat room, but she's having some trouble with Adobe. You should talk to Jay Scott about that, Lori. But we're glad you're still in. But if at any point you're knocked out and want to ask a question, just speak up. Moving on to examiner determination, it says the examiner shall make a determination in accordance with the URS procedure. And the procedure, of course, is just implementation of the rules we're reviewing. These rules and any rules or principles of law that it deems applicable. That raises a question for me. Has any examiner in a URS any ever invoked rules and principles of law beyond the URS procedure, rules and procedure itself? The determination will be in writing, provide the reasons on which it's based, indicate the date on which it was rendered, and identify the name of the examiner. I don't know if it's a question for the providers, but I do want to note at this point in regard to 13B that we have learned from the providers sub-team that not all of the URS decisions even state the name of the complainant's attorney, and if there's been a response of the respondent's attorney, which surprised me because those are always listed in a UDRP. And I know that I've seen some URS decisions which simply say, this is the standard, and I find that it's been met, and I suspend the domain without listing the trademark on which the complaint was based, or any description, even a one-sentence description of the content at the website. So I don't believe it's a question for the examiners, but I do believe it's a an issue for the working group whether we want to expand this to expand slightly without burdening the examiner in this very fast-track, low-cost process, just including some basic elements to be required in the decision. That's a personal view. Others may disagree, but I think it's something the working group should consider, that a decision should at least list the names of the counsel involved for respondent, for complainant and respondent, should state the trademark or trademarks involved, and should have at least a sentence about what, if anything, was at the website. That would certainly help with further future review of URS. I have seen some decisions which don't have those very basic elements in them, and asking examiners to list them wouldn't seem particularly burdensome. So going on to C, examiner determination shall normally comply with the guidelines. I have a question. I'm not sure what the guidelines are as to length set forth in the provider's supplemental rules. I think the term guidelines is confusing there. If the examiner concludes that the dispute is not within the scope of the URS provider, it shall state. We do know from Berry's review of cases that in some minority of cases, the examiners have said, this is not a black and white case. It needs to go to litigation or to a UDRP. But I'm not sure there's a question for an examiner here, because I think with the if we ask the providers, have your examiners complied with your supplemental rules? I think they'd all tell us that they have. I think that's something for a third party, if anyone, to look at, and we're just considering questions to providers right now. And finally, if after considering the submissions, the examiner finds that the complaint was brought in bad faith or primarily to harass the domain name holder, it shall declare in its determination that the complaint was brought in bad faith and constitutes an abuse. Again, Barry has analyzed cases and identified any that have where such a determination has been made. So does anyone see any questions to the providers arising out of Section 13 here? Other than asking the providers whether any examiners have ever invoked rules and principles of law beyond the URS standard itself. Justine?
Yes, sir, Justine for the record. So I typed two questions into the chat. Thanks.
Yeah, okay, I see your questions. How many examiners' determinations? You know, that would be something for the working group to determine if it does some type of qualitative review of URS decisions. I do know from personal experience that I've seen some which are very bare bones and simply state that the examiner has found the burden of proof to be met by the complainant without any further information. The guidelines, we have those. Staff has found those are the supplemental rules, and I believe the inartful reference to guidelines seems to be simply to be to the supplemental rules and what they state as to length. And but I think the that's the length of the decision, not the length of the submission from the complainant or the respondent that's being referred to there. So at some point we'll be going through the supplemental rules to make sure that they're not in conflict with the ICANN rules and procedures and that they don't change the policy in any way. But it doesn't suggest a question to the providers. Mike, Justine, I don't know if that's a new hand or an old hand. So let me call
Sorry,
on Michael.
Old hand.
Okay, old hand. Michael, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure if the providers are the right people to ask this, but I'd be interested to know how often 13D is invoked and what factors have been considered in making that determination. Thanks.
Yeah, well, 13B is simply saying that the decision determination shall be in writing, and of course they're all in writing, and provide the reason on which
Sorry,
you state.
That was
D. Date.
That was 13D, not 13B. D?
13D. Okay, and what was your question on that, or suggestion?
How often and with what frequency, if it's been invoked, with what frequency it's been invoked and what factors have been considered in making that determination?
Yeah, I agree with you. That's a good question to ask the providers, whether any examiner has used that discretionary authority under 13D. Okay, moving on to 14. This is simply the remedies. It says the sole remedy is suspension of the domain for the balance of the registration period, which for most new TLD domains is usually a year. There's very few that are, to my knowledge, that are initially registered beyond a year. But there may be some. And I think, again, Barry has analyzed that from the data available. And if the complainant wishes to extend the remedy, that is to extend the suspension, they shall contact the registry operator directly regarding this option. So I don't see any questions for the providers there. It simply says that the sole remedy is suspension of the domain. It's up to the working group whether that should be expanded to something further, because we have heard from trademark interest that the fact that suspension is the only remedy is a disincentive for filing a URS. that they'd like something more permanent than suspension for the remainder of the registration period. And it would be the registries, not the examiner, not the provider, who would know whether a complainant has ever asked for an extension of the suspension under 14B. So I don't see any questions suggested by Section 14. Does anyone see any that I'm missing? Okay, not hearing anyone. Moving on to 15. 15A says the provider shall publish the determination and the dates of implementation on a publicly accessible website. I think they're all doing that. We can ask staff to check that out just as they checked out the examiner qualifications. But I think all the URS decisions are being published by the respective providers. That they're subject to change only to correct typographical and clerical errors and can't be substantively changed. A final determination that changes a default determination outcome for the same case shall replace the default determination on the website unless the examiner determines both shall be made available. I guess, you know, Barry's identified a small number of cases where there was a final determination after an initial default determination. That, of course, would be after a respondent came in and after the initial decision. I guess we could ask the providers whether any examiner has ever said that the final, that both decisions, if they differ, should be in the published at the website. That's just a factual question. Okay, D, a final determination that upholds a default determination may be published together on the provider's website where it can replace the default determination. That's kind of the same, raises the same question as C, whether their practice is to replace the initial determination with the new one or put up both for reasons of historical information. The examiner or panel has the sole discretion to require the appeal determination to be published either instead of, together with, or together with the default or final determination it has overruled or upheld. So these are all pretty much saying the same thing, is that the examiner can determine whether if there's a new final decision, whether it's published along with the initial default decision or replaces it. So, again, I think we just ask the providers what their practice is or what their experience has been. And determinations related to the same domain name and their parties, but not part of the same case, need not be linked. I don't think that suggests any questions. It just means they...
Each
decision
still
stands at its own. Yes, Lori, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm out of Adobe and looking at the rules from a PDF. Adobe's kicked me out like 5 times today. Doesn't like me. I just wondered, just thinking this through, and it says determinations related to the same domains and our parties that are not part of the same case need not be linked. But are they linked? Or are they definitely not linked? I mean, does linking help complainants or respondents in any way? I mean, should they be linked? I'm not sure why they need not be linked. Why wouldn't maybe we want them to be linked? I think it does ask a question about efficacy. Is this information that would be helpful to the community?
I think you raise a good issue, Lori. You know, right now for our exercise of developing questions for the providers, you know, we can ask them what their practice is. Do they link them when they now it says the same domain name or parties. Parties can refer to the complainant or the respondent.
Or the respondent, correct. But the linkages could show patterns. And I agree, this is about the process of the provider. But whatever their process is, there's going to be an output that may or may not be useful to the community. So to your point, yes, I think the only question here is they need not be linked, but has any provider linked them? And if so, why? Or if so, why not? I mean, if the why not is, well, we don't have to.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I think that's a worthwhile question. I think there's also a small p policy issue here, whether given that there are three separate providers and there may be more than three in the future, whether ICANN should be aggregating the decisions on one central website, that because you could have a bad actor registrant with an action brought in the different in the three different providers, and let's say three separate cases against the same registrant, the provider wouldn't know about the other cases, but if they were linked on one aggregated database, it would show that that particular registrant had a pattern and practice of cyber squatting. So that might be worthwhile. That's more of a issue for the working group, whether we want to recommend aggregation of the decisions by ICANN into one central database. I think we'll probably face the same issue when we get onto the UDRP next year. Because each provider has a totally different database, and they're not linked in any way.
So I would say, yes, that would be helpful, I think, all the way around. So I would certainly just ask the question so we get it on the record. I would suggest, since this language say need not, probably not, but let's get that confirmed.
Right. And we could, you know, if there's a consensus, we could recommend that be changed to requiring them to both show cases brought by multiple complainants and cases that were brought against the same respondent by different complainants, or by the same complainant from multiple websites.
Correct. But you're going to see, though, I would caution with that, just as you'll definitely see patterns, because you'll see larger brands typically probably use this enforcement mechanism than others. But you will definitely see patterns, and I think the patterns could be interesting.
Agreed. All right, moving on to 17. Effect of court proceedings. If there's a legal proceeding initial or initiated prior to or during a URS, the examiner shall have discretion to decide whether to suspend or terminate the URS proceeding. Again, I think Barry has probably identified whether that's ever happened. And then B says, the party, if that's done, the party shall promptly notify the examiner if there's a court case initiated during the pendency of a URS proceeding, which is a very short pendency, I would point out. It's only 2 to 3 weeks.
Sorry, this is Ariel.
And then it says the examiner shall have the discretion to decide whether to suspend or terminate. I would suggest here that we get back to Barry's analysis and see whether he's identified any cases where a court case was brought, and then if we can identify any of those cases, see what the examiner has done. But this is similar to the UDRP, where if there's a intervening court case, the examiner has discretion whether to continue the proceeding or dissolve it. Does anyone think we need to ask the examiners, the providers, whether they've ever experienced this?
Phil, it's Lori.
Yeah, Lori.
I would, because inquiring minds may want to know how often these issues are crossing between the administrative and the civil, any sort of civil proceeding.
Sure. We can ask. I'm expecting that it'd be very rare. A complainant that's filed a URS would be highly unlikely to file a court case in the very brief period that the URS takes from filing to determination. And given that there are default determinations in more than half of all URS cases, it'd be rare for a respondent to file a lawsuit against a complainant in that very brief period. I see Ariel's hand up. Ariel?
Thanks, Phil. I just wanted to remind you that we skipped Section 16 and went straight to 17.
What was that, Ariel? I'm sorry, I didn't understand you.
I was just reminding we skipped Section 16, settlement, or other grounds for termination. We didn't talk about questions and comments
section. Oh, thank you for pointing that out. That is my error, and I apologize for that. I scrolled too aggressively. So I think we're through with 17. We're just going to ask the providers whether they've had that situation of an intervening lawsuit during an active URS case. 16 says if the parties agree on a settlement, the examiner shall terminate the URS proceeding. And B says that if before the determination becomes unnecessary or impossible to continue the URS proceeding for any reason, the examiner shall terminate the proceeding unless a party raises justifiable grounds. Well, A is pretty clear. If the parties settle, the URS stops. You know, they have to notify the examiner that they've settled. I'm imagining that would usually involve turning over the domain to the complainant in terms of the content of the settlement. I guess we could ask the providers whether any examiner they know of has ever found it unnecessary or impossible to continue the proceeding under subsection B. And if they've tried to do so, whether any party has raised justifiable grounds for not doing that. I think this is going to be a rare outlier situation, but we can ask. No harm in asking. Anybody else have comments on Section 16 on settlement or other grounds for termination? Okay, then we'll move on to 18, abusive cases. The examiner can, on his or her own, find that a complaint is abusive or contains deliberate material falsehoods. A respondent may, in its response, allege that a complaint was brought to abuse the URS process or contains deliberate material falsehoods. Any findings by an examiner as to abusive complaints or deliberate falsehoods shall be so stated in the determination with sufficient rationale. Any provider registering a case of abuse as described in the URS procedure paragraph 11 shall within one business day submit information of the abuse case to an abuse case database. So D certainly suggests a question to the provider saying, have you ever done this, since that's a duty for them to do that upon notification from the examiner of a finding of abuse. And it's supposed to be, the case is supposed to be electronically accessible to all providers. I think that's something we would ask staff to check out. Where is that? I think we want to ask staff to determine that there is, in fact, an abuse case database that is accessible to all providers. So would staff please note that? And upon receipt of a complaint, the provider shall verify the admissibility of the complaint against the abuse case database. So that would suggest a question to providers whether they do that in each and every case, whether they check that the complainant is not one listed in this abuse case database. I think Barry has identified those cases in which abuse or material deliberate falsehood was found. Any other questions suggested here for providers by Section 18? Other than asking whether they, as a matter of course, check that a complainant is not listed in that abuse case database. I'm not seeing any hands or hearing anyone, so we'll say that's about it for Section 18. Appeal, there have been a very limited number of appeals, again, based on Barry's analysis. Appeal, this says the provider has to provide the entire record in the underlying proceeding to the appeal panel. That's more than just the decision. It's all the filings by the complainant and the respondent, if there was a response. That the appellant should have a limited right to introduce new admissible evidence, material to the determination, subject to payment of an additional fee. I think the fee is set by the supplemental rules. We can look at that. The appellee shall not be charged any additional fee and shall have the right to file a reply within the time period set in the provider supplemental rules. If the respondent prevails and the domain name is no longer under suspension or lock, the provider shall notify the registry operator to relock the domain name. So the first part of this refers to the initial decision and then an appeal in which the complainant prevails. E says if any domain name is subject of an appeal, is expired at the time of the filing, the provider shall reject the appeal for want of a remedy unless the appeal is only filed under U.S. Procedure Paragraph 11.8. We'll have to come back to that when we get to Paragraph 11.8 of the procedures. Justine, I see your hand up. Let me just get through this, and then we'll hear you. The remedies for an appeal are limited to affirmation of the final determination or overruling the final determination and the remedy ordered. And that would unlock the domain name if it was suspended and return full control to the registrant, or overruling an examiner's finding that a complaint was abusive or contained a deliberate material falsehood. So appeals can be not just on whether or not there was cyber squatting, but whether or not the examiner properly found abusive behavior by the complainant or deliberate material falsehood in the complaint. And other than determining that providers are complying with this process for appeals, and there's a very small number of appeals that we know of, they've been identified, I don't know of any additional questions this suggests, but Justine, your hand is up. Go ahead.
Hi, Justine, for the record. 19B, I just wondered, obviously, the suggests that the provider won't do anything with the appeal unless the payment of the fee is completed. But just in terms of the phrase, limited right to introduce new admissible evidence that is material to the determination, I just wonder whether the providers actually do any administrative check on that. Who actually exercises that review before it goes to the panel or the appeals process?
Uh, That's a good question. I guess we could ask the providers how they, in practice, implement 19B. If someone appeals a decision or a finding of abuse or deliberate material falsehood, how do they determine that the appellant is in fact seeking to introduce new admissible evidence that clearly predates the filing of the complaint? So I guess that would be the question to them. That may be correct.
Yeah. So in,
I want to wait till we're supplemental rules.
Okay. I mean, the obvious question would be, for example, do the providers just check in terms of the new evidence to be admitted whether it predates the filing of the complaint? Or do they do further examination on top of that? Further review on top of that?
Yeah, let's list that as a tentative question, though. I think, again, it may be explained in their supplemental rules. So it's a potential question, but the supplemental rules may answer it. And I'm happy to state. Yep, go ahead. Justine, do you have anything further on that?
No, just agreeing with you, Phil. So if we just put a bookmark on that and just check whether it's resolved in the procedures or the supplemental rules. Sorry.
Okay. Section 20, exclusion of liability. It says except in the case of deliberate wrongdoing, neither provider nor examiner shall be liable to a party for any act or omission in connection with any URS proceeding under these rules. I'm just going to note that in my personal opinion, this is clearly an attempt by ICANN to limit the liability of the provider or the examiner. If they were sued, it would be up to a court in which the suit was filed to determine whether this exclusion in fact provided protection to them. But I think the only question to the providers, and I'd be surprised if they said yes, was whether they've ever been sued directly or know that an examiner has been sued as a result of a URS decision. I'd be surprised if that ever happened, but we might ask that question. So we can put that on our list of questions. And 21 amendments, the version of these rules in effect at the time of submission of the complaint shall apply to the URS proceeding commenced thereby. They can't be amended without the express written approval of ICANN. Well, the rules have never changed since they were published in the applicant guidebook. They might change as a result of recommendations made by this working group, but I don't see any questions suggested by Section 21 because the rules are as they always have been since the URS was initiated, and any changes would be a result of recommendations made by this working group that were approved by council and then approved by the ICANN board. So I don't see anything out of 21. So we have now completed our review of the rules. It's 4 minutes after the hour. I don't think we should get into the procedures. I would suggest that we take a quick, if staff has it available, does staff have any of the copies of the MOU available to take a look at? I'm assuming that they're identical for all three providers. I can't imagine that ICANN has entered into materially different contracts with the three providers to administer the same RPM. But if we have the one available for NAF, which is decided, that's the ADN-DRC. Do we have the NAF one available? Because they've done about 90% of the cases. And I suggest that we look at the MOU because it's only a 2-page document. So I think we can get through it pretty quickly to see if it suggests any questions to providers. So all of Section 1 is just a whereas clause that says ICANN has developed a program for new TLDs, and then it requires the registry operator to comply with decisions made under the URS, and NAF desires to act as a provider, so I don't see any questions there. Section 2 says NAF and ICANN agree as follows. ICANN designates National Arbitration Forum as a provider of URS services. B says NAF shall implement the URS services in accordance with URS procedures as well as the rules, and that's the exercise we're going through to determine if they're doing that. Develop and maintain provider-specific supplemental rules necessary to facilitate the URS, provided that they don't contravene or be inconsistent with the URS procedure or rules. Well, we're going to take a look at each provider supplemental rules for exactly that purpose, to make sure that they're simply implementing the rules and procedures and not changing them or changing the underlying policy. Select each examiner and appeal panel to make sure that each examiner and appeal panel member is properly qualified, including an understanding of local IP issues. Well, we're looking at that by reviewing the qualifications that were published, so I don't see anything additional needed on that. Ensure that all URS determinations are publicly posted and searchable, and this working group is, this sub-team is already looking at that. Establish and maintain a conflicts of interest policy and procedure. All right, I think that raises a question, is what is the conflicts of interest policy adopted by each provider? Establish and maintain a payment account system. Establish and maintain procedures and processes for efficient communications with. We've already raised questions about communications in last week's review of the rules. Establish and maintain a process to monitor URS abuse. We just covered that section of the rules. Provide ICANN with any information or data it may reasonably request. We might ask ICANN whether it's ever requested any information from the providers since the URS process started. And ICANN and NAF shall communicate regularly with each other and seek to optimize the URS services provided. I think that suggests asking ICANN and the providers, have they in fact had this regular communication that's required by this contract? And in the event that NAF fails to comply, ICANN may terminate NAF status. Well, that clearly hasn't happened. NAF maintains a U.S. Continues to be a URS provider, in fact, the provider of the majority of URS determinations, and NAF has not exercised its option to terminate the MOU. So other than asking about regular, whether ICANN has asked the NAF or any other provider to provide it with information, and whether they're communicating regularly with one another, I don't see any questions raised by the MOU beyond what we've already identified as arising from the rules and may identify as arising from the procedures. Michael, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, although in reflection, this may be already included in the questions we've previously established. But I'd be interested in information about what, if any, conflicts have been found and what remedial action has been taken. I wrote that in the chat, but in retrospect, I have a vague memory that I might have suggested in the previous call, so apologies if that's already one of the questions we're asking.
Yeah, well, again, I agree, Michael, and again, since the MLU requires each NAF and presumably the other providers to establish and maintain a conflicts policy, we want to ask them, have you done that? Have you adopted a conflicts policy, and have you ever had to use it? So anybody else think there's any, other than the conflicts and the communication between ICANN and the provider, I don't see any other questions suggested by a review of the MOU. Does anyone else? All right, so it's now 11 after the hour. I don't want to start going through the procedures. That's a long, complex document, and there's no sense getting into it with only 19 minutes left. I think we've made a lot of progress. In two sessions, we've completely reviewed the URS rules, which are the basis for the procedures. So the procedures, I'm not sure how many more questions they'll give rise to. Since they're all based on the rules, and we've pulled a lot of questions out from our review of the rules. So next steps, I think we're done. I would suggest we wrap up for tonight. Next steps, next meeting, we're going to report on our progress at ICANN 61. We're going to review the questions, any questions for providers arising from the practitioner and document subteams. I understand there are a few that they've come up with for providers that may be the same as some we've already developed or may be different, so we'll take that into account. And a number of future meetings. I'm guessing, given the rapidity of this process, that if we continue at this pace, what we have left is review of the supplemental rules and review of these review of the procedures and then the supplemental rules. I'm guessing we can wrap that up in another two or three sessions. So we may do some of that at ICANN on the final day. I'm not sure if we're going to be working there, whether the data subteam is going to be working. Does staff recall what our plans are for that final 90 minutes at ICANN 61? That's the Thursday morning meeting. Is that going to be for the data subteam or for these subteams?
This is Ariel from staff, and I think the thinking was to repurpose that for the data subteam, but we're doing this quick survey to understand how many people from the subteam and the working group in general are going to be in ICANN 60. So with that data, we probably can make a better decision how to repurpose that session.
Okay. All right. So that's still in flux, but even if we don't have that session at ICANN, I would think that by late March, early April, we'll have reviewed everything else. We'll have a list of questions for providers and some for ICANN, small number for ICANN. We can get them out to the providers. They're very objective questions. I would guess the providers, if we can get them out in the first half of April, I would think the providers could get back with answers by late April, early May, and then we can proceed to discuss, based on those answers, any proposals for changes in the URS based on that work and the work of the other subteams. So I think we're in good shape here because we're not going to have the results of the data survey on trademark claims and Sunrise back until mid to late July, so that we have all that time to work on the URS. So I'm encouraged by our timeline and by the very rapid progress we've made on this set team in reviewing the provider documents and coming up with relevant questions. Anybody have any comments on that?
Hi, Phil. I would just say you've pulled the laboring oar, I think, in terms of going through these, and it was helpful. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Lori. And, I'm encouraged. I think, you know, we should aim for, as both sub-teams and as a full working group, I would like to, before we start dealing with the answers from those data surveys on Sunrise and trademark claims, it's certainly my hope as a co-chair that we've pretty much wrapped up URS, that we've come up with questions for providers, we've gotten answers, and we've queued up a list of suggestions for modifying the URS, whatever they are, and get into them. It doesn't mean we've taken a consensus call, but it means we pretty much reviewed the URS. We know how many cases were filed, what happened in them, based on Barry's analysis and all of that. So I think we're making good progress here. Ariel, I see your hand up.
Thanks, Phil. There's also a question from Yvette. I can go after her.
Yeah, I see her question on the high-level technical requirements. Yeah, I think we, you know, Yvette, since you're with a provider, yeah, I think we should look at that. I'm not sure if there's any, unless you're having problems with those technical requirements, I'm not sure we have to deal with them, but I think we certainly should review them since we are the ones looking at providers and those are requirements for the providers. So, yeah, and forgive me for not mentioning them. Even though they're technical in nature, we should at least devote some time to taking note of what's in there and finding out if they're creating any problems. So the answer is yes. So with that, there's 13 minutes left. I'm going to give you back 13 minutes of your life unless somebody wants to make a further statement or raise a question.
This is Ariel from staff. Just
yes, Ariel. Go ahead.
Question. Thank you. One further question is, do we still want to do this rotation of APAC time zone where we will stick to the usual time as 1800 UTC for the future, given our attendance is not a lot this meeting?
Yeah, you know, let's see. I'm hoping, I don't think our next meeting, if we don't meet in San Juan, if we don't use that last 90 minutes in San Juan, then our next call would be the last week of March. I don't think we should, even though it's the last week, that we should have another APAC time zone call that last week in March. So I'm just suggesting that we, hold that at the regular time of 1700 UTC, and hopefully this sub-team can wrap up its work before the end of April and we won't have to deal with that question. So that's my suggestion as co-chair and ex officio member of this sub-team. All right. So thank you all. We wrapped up the rules tonight. We completed our review of the MOU. So we're a good way through our task at the end of two meetings. So thank you all, and have a good evening or a good rest of the day, whatever time of day it is for you. And for those of you that are coming to San Juan, we'll see you there and safe travel. There'll be no further meetings of this sub-team until San Juan or after San Juan. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much. Meeting has been adjourned.